Om Namah Shivaya Gurave Satchidanandamurtaye Nishprapanchaya Shantaya Niralambaya Tejase Muktanandaya Gurave Shisha Samsara Harane Bhaktakaya Ekadehaya Namaste Chitsaratmane Hetave Jagatameva Samsara Navasetave Prabhave Sabhavidyanam Shambhave Gurave Namaha Guru Brahma Guru Vishnu Guru Devo Maheshvara Guru Sakshat Parabrahma Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Om Svarupa Swaswabhava Namo Namaha Om I bow to your inherent beingness, your own existence, your own self. I bow to my inherent beingness, my own existence, my own self. I bow to that one reality that is being yourself and myself. I bow to that reality in the form of Muktananda, who showed me my own self. And I bow to everyone and everything that exists as a form of that one reality, Shiva. Again and again I bow. Om Swarupa Swaswabhava Namo Namaha. So for those of you that are new to the Shisha calls, and we do have more people on this call than we've had on the prior one, so I'm thinking some of you might be new to the Shisha calls. They're a little bit different than the Q&A satsangs. I do usually two calls every month, one just for Shishas, which is this call, and the other one is a satsang that's open to everybody. All you have to do is sign up for the satsangi membership. I think it costs $1 for 40 years. It's very affordable. And that's questions and answers. What I do on the Shisha call is I bring teachings that I can't really give to a group of newcomers. I teach satsangs here at Downingtown Yoga, our public facility, and in other places, particularly when I'm traveling. And usually there's somebody new or they're starting into a process of learning a bit about this, and I need to include introductory material. Well, I'm always happy to do that. You guys don't need that introductory material. Of course, you do need to be reminded that you are Shiva. You are consciousness. You need to be reminded of that again and again. And I will do that again and again. But there's intricacies and there's depth to be explored that is really only available when I'm teaching a group of people who maybe, like, we just finished the retreat. So when we got into the fifth and sixth and seventh days of the retreat, I could do some things that I wasn't able to do the first and second and third days because people were going a little deeper. So I make the assumption that by the time you're interested in calling yourself a Shisha and you go online and fill out our little application form and get accepted into the program, that I'm able to share some of these deeper teachings with you. Still, like any teacher, I love to have conversation, questions, and answers. So what I'll do is I'll explain some stuff, I'll give some teachings, I'll stop, and I'll see if you have any questions or if you can make a comment about your own experience of the things that I'm talking about. Today, what I'm going to talk about is what the word Shisha means. I thought it'd be a good thing to do is to define Shisha and what the Shisha program is all about. Shisha means disciple. I mean, we're not used to using the word disciple much in everyday English. Usually the word disciple refers to the 12 disciples that followed Jesus and carried his message out to the Western world and established a profound religious base for millions and millions and millions of people today. So they were disciples. So what does it mean that you are a Shisha and you call yourself a disciple? Disciple means one who's doing the practices, one who's not just talking the talk, but actually walking the walk. A little bit later in the call, I'm actually going to ask you, what practices do you do? I recognize that most of you can't adopt an ashram-like lifestyle. You're not going to be able to. Maybe you can, but most of you have many things that would get in the way of, say, you chanting the Guru Gita and doing a meditation afterwards every morning. And you might have difficulty sitting down and doing a meditation again every evening. In the ashram, we do almost 3 hours a day of shared practices. And then each of us who lives here has, in addition to that, our own asana practice and our own meditation practice, as we do short meditations when we get together. And so that might not fit in your lifestyle. When I ask you about practices, I'm not suggesting that you should be doing all of these things, but rather to find out really on a very practical matter what works for you and that can be inspiring to other people. How much you're able to fit in, or if your lifestyle is set up so that you can actually prioritize your yoga practice, and it's the other things that you fit in. How do you sort that out? The word disciple comes from the word discipline. And now I have to explain another English word. This is before we've gotten into any Sanskrit even. Most people think that discipline means punishment. But if you look it up and you see what's going on, what discipline means is like a musician who practices every day, who sets themselves up with a discipline so that they can cultivate a skill or accomplish a certain objective. An athlete has their athletic discipline. An artist, a musician, someone who's learning a new language, they have to go about it in a very disciplined manner. You have to do a little bit every day. The regular practice of yoga is, in fact, called not just yoga practice, but yoga discipline. So one who does the discipline is then called a disciple. Baba was very clear about the difference between disciples and devotees. And he talked to us about this repeatedly because so many people, of course, fell into the devotee category. Most of us who were living with him were certainly devoted, but also doing the discipline. And in living with him in the ashram and being on an ashram staff, that included a lot of seva, but we also did the Guru Gita. We also did our own asana practices. We did lots of other practices aside from the seva. And we placed ourselves in a living situation where that could be the focus of our lives. And there were lots of people who were truly disciples that were not able to live in the ashram and did not come and move their whole life in there, but they would come as they could for weekends or for retreats and follow the teachings at home and do the practices at home. But by far the largest number of people who came to see Baba really fell in the category of devotees, which is they'd come and they'd sit in the meditation hall. And then when Baba walked in, they'd go, "Oh, Baba's here. Oh, Baba!" And maybe wave at him. Or when they came up in darshan, say, "Oh, Baba, I've arrived." And they'd get very excited. They loved Baba, truly devoted, deeply felt it in their heart, really felt that Baba had made a great change in their lives. But when they went home, they didn't do the discipline. They didn't do the practices. And it's been interesting for me now, 30 years after Baba left his body, especially since I've become a Swami and am in a fairly public role, to have people that I knew from those years getting in touch with me. Various times I'll hear from various people, or running into them in different ashrams that I teach in, retreat centers that I teach in, even, you know, in India and different places that I go, I'll run into these people that were either on staff or came frequently to see Baba. I got to know hundreds, if not a thousand people in that time period. And I can see that they don't get it. And they're still very devoted to Baba. They still have a great love for him. But they never really incorporated what Baba taught them into their lifestyle. What does it mean to be a shisha? To be a shisha means you walk the walk. You don't just talk the talk. And I have a selection to read for you from one of Muktananda's books. It's called The Perfect Relationship. It's the guru-disciple relationship. And he tells a story. He says, one morning, Guru Bhagavan Sheikh Sahib was giving a lecture in a coffee house. The room was crowded because the price of admission was very low. The Sheikh began to speak about high knowledge, true religion and perfect teachings. He said, all gurus except me are false. Only I am perfect and true. No one has ever attained as much knowledge as I have, and no one has ever taught this kind of knowledge. Be happy and behave in whatever way you like. After he had given this teaching, he said, now I am going to give you my final instructions. It is wicked to smoke cigarettes, so give them up. It is wrong to drink liquor. Moreover, men, you should not spend time with women unnecessarily. With these words, he concluded his lecture and then added, if anyone wants to ask a question, he may do so. One man stood up and said, O Sheikh, there is a pack of cigarettes in your pocket. The Sheikh replied, yes, I smoke. A second man said, O Sheikh Sahib, I always see you drinking liquor in bars. Oh, yes, said the Sheikh, it's my daily practice. Another one said, I see you walking around the park with a different woman every day. Yes, of course, I do that. Then what were you talking about at the end of your lecture? Sheikh Sahib said, oh, I was just imparting knowledge to you. I don't follow it myself. One cannot obtain strength from such gurus. A sadguru should be like a supremely holy place of pilgrimage. So Baba was saying you have to test your guru. You have to look at who you're going to study with and what discipline they're going to recommend to you to do. Because if they're not following the discipline, then why should you? If they're giving teachings that they haven't imbibed, then how can you learn anything from them? Baba spoke frequently about the importance of testing your guru and knowing that what your guru is offering you is a living teaching, and that it's tried and true, and that it follows the teachings of the ancients and the way they've been carried down through the generations. But he also spoke very movingly about the importance of the guru testing the disciple. He described very clearly the qualities that a disciple should have, quoting from texts that make this clear. In the Kulanava Tantra, I'm quoting Muktananda, we have examined the characteristics of the guru. He actually has 30 more pages on it. The path shown by the guru, and some of the effects of the guru's grace. Now, let us look at the recipient of that grace, the disciple. Like the Sadguru, a worthy disciple has specific characteristics. In the Kulanava Tantra, Shiva describes the false disciple in this way. He is wicked, lacks virtues, and comes from a corrupt family. He is a heretic and takes pride only in dry and scholarly knowledge. He becomes the disciple of any teacher he encounters. He performs bad actions and is given to self-praise and lacks perfection. He is shunned by the members of his family and by society. His parents, fellow townsmen, and guru reject him. The mere sight of him creates fear. He is foul-mouthed. He dresses in whatever way he likes. Sometimes he becomes a sadhu. At other times he tosses away his sadhu clothing and gets a job. He takes the great initiation of sannyasa, and then he gets married and falls from his vows. His speech creates restlessness and fear. After listing the qualities, the characteristics of a false disciple, the text described the qualities of a good, pure, fortunate, and virtuous disciple. Quoting the text, he or she is engaged in sadhana, that's the practices, leading to samadhi. And then he details yama, niyama, asana, the techniques of hatha yoga, natural pranayama, and so on. He is endowed with noble qualities. He is good-natured and behaves correctly. He is worthy of receiving the shakti from the guru and the knowledge of the truth. He has a pure mind and is gifted with faith and devotion. He knows the scriptures. He is endowed with a beautiful body and wears clean clothes. He observes good conduct. Such a disciple is deserving of initiation. Going on, he performs actions with understanding and with unselfish motives. He has a generous mind and is a profound thinker. He eats sparingly. He is careful and competent in his actions. He is courageous and free of pride. such a noble person is qualified for initiation. The text goes on. He carries out all his actions with great skill. He finds joy in helping others. He is pure because of his virtuous actions and is afraid to perform sinful deeds. He is grateful and assimilates the qualities of noble people. He is a staunch believer. He is charitable and is engaged in service to others. He never deceives people or takes away their money. He is worthy of the Guru's trust. He is humble, egoless, free of pride, and always happy. Such a person is a worthy disciple. His speech is beneficial to others. It is true, pure. It always brings joy. He speaks little. He is very intelligent and sharp-witted. When he is told something once, he understands it. Such an intelligent disciple is the child of the Guru and qualified to receive the knowledge of the Absolute. He dislikes hearing himself praised and others criticized. He is always pleased and eager to do for others work that is important to them. He has mastered his senses and is disciplined in his actions. Now, it goes on, but the point of all of this is that such a yogi is able to receive the Shakti that is transmitted through Shaktipat and through contact with the Guru, through the grace. So the summary, Baba says, such a person is worthy of receiving supreme initiation. Between him and the Guru, there exists the relationship of father and child. A true disciple nurtures the secret knowledge taught by the Guru. Never disobeys the Guru's command. Because the disciple considers the Guru to be Shiva, all attainments come to him on their own. So what are you doing to nurture the Shakti that you have received? What are you doing to nurture the secret knowledge that is arising in you? What are you doing that makes the wealth of yoga grow in you? So I just finished teaching the retreat. We did the Guru Gita meditation early morning before breakfast. And then they did almost 3-hour asana class every morning. And then in the afternoon, we did three and a half hours of vichara. And in the evening, chanting and meditation. Lots of very deep and intense practices. It was so lovely to watch them sort of peel themselves off the floor just before lunch, after 3 hours of asana, and kind of roll up and see this beautiful, peaceful, open face with deep and radiant eyes, to see them get up and start moving blankets around the room and getting ready for bringing out the lunch tables and things. And each day they moved a little slower. It was very cute to watch. We hit about the fourth day and it took them 10 minutes to even begin clearing the blankets out of the middle of the room. It was like, okay, we're getting there. We're slowing down now. What actually happens is you don't have to slow down to live in that blissful state. So you know how you feel when you finish that practice. Do you still feel that way an hour later? Do you still feel that way 5 hours later? Do you still feel that way 10 hours later? This is called a steady state. And if other people are mirroring that back to you, then you're more solid in your state than they are. If one person is peaceful and another person is upset and they talk to one another, the one who is most established in their state will shift the other one. Now, how established can someone be when they're upset? So if they're beginning to reciprocally adapt to you, then you are more established in your state than they are in theirs. This is Baba's yardstick. How do you feel on the inside? The cooks prepared a wonderful dessert for us one particular day. And there was some of that dessert left over and brought back out the next day. So I was talking with one of the yogis there and she said, oh, they just brought such and such a dessert out again. She said, I think I'll go get some more of that. And then she got a little worried because, of course, she was talking to me. And she said, is that dependent bliss? And I said, yes, but there's nothing wrong with dependent bliss. As long as when you eat that delicious dessert and it makes you blissful, the bliss never ends. The problem is that the bliss stops and you go back to what you call normal. But if the bliss continued and it didn't drop off, then the next time they brought out the dessert, you could have it or not have it. You'd already be as blissful as it would normally make you. You'd be that way all the time. This is called a steady state. This is the purpose of the practices, is to give you the steady state. I have conversations with people frequently. They're saying, well, is yoga going to help me with my neck pain? And the answer is yes. And is yoga going to help me with gaining weight or losing weight or improving my digestion or my immune system or whatever? And the answer is yes, as long as you're doing the practices and you're consistent and diligent and you give your body time that it needs to go through the healing process, this is going to work. But they never say, is yoga going to improve my state? People don't begin to consider the true purpose of yoga's practice until they've had some experience with yoga and they've had some teachings and they've been developing and cultivating their practice. People don't really begin to understand the true purpose of the practices until they're shishas, that it's about cultivating and supporting and maintaining your state. What do you do and how do you support your state? I'm going to go back to Baba and read a few more excerpts from what he's written here. He writes now about the qualities of a true guru. A true guru is proficient at distinguishing between that which is correct and that which is incorrect according to scriptural doctrines. One can perceive the supreme principle through his mere gesture. By hearing the guru speak, one is freed from delusion and doubts, and can understand even the most difficult subjects. Only such a guru is worthy of giving Shaktipat initiation and knowledge of the truth. Even though his eyes appear to look outside, his gaze is constantly fixed on the inner self. He can pierce the chakras. He gives one the wisdom of the self. He is serene and bestows compassion on all people. He moves through the world with his senses under control. He has conquered the six inner enemies. The six enemies are desire, greed, anger, lust, envy, and infatuation. Through the power of the self, the guru transmits its shakti into others. Only such a compassionate guru can uplift his disciples. He is proficient in all actions. He has attained the fearlessness of the self. He regards all deities and religions as equal. Only such an incomparable being is a guru. He is free of attachment. He is always happy and independent. He is brave and compassionate. He is always smiling and his speech brings joy. He reveals the meaning of wisdom and righteousness. He remains satisfied with whatever comes to him through God's will. Only such a superior person is a guru worthy of initiating disciples into the knowledge of the Absolute. Baba often made the comparison of the guru with the philosopher's stone. The philosopher's stone is something that dates back to the medieval alchemists. Many stories and teachings that come from this era of spiritual endeavor are told in allegorical or metaphorical terms, that the alchemists were supposedly trying to turn base metal into gold, and that when they found the right stone or they created an instrument that would do it, that was called the philosopher's stone. The system was really to turn the base metal of the human being into the golden of the divine. And it was really about discovering the divinity within humanity. But it was the philosopher's stone that would transform the base metal into gold. So Baba always used this as a metaphor for the guru. And he describes it this way. When iron comes into contact with the philosopher's stone, it is transmuted into gold. Sandalwood trees infuse their fragrance into the trees around them. In the same way, the guru makes a true disciple like himself. The purpose of having a guru is not so that you can be a disciple, but so that your discipleship makes you discover what the guru has discovered. You don't merely get transformed from iron into gold, you become a philosopher's stone. So Baba's description of the guru is a description of your future. Though you may not have the karma or the dharma to serve as a guru who's giving initiation and stepping out into public and serving in this way, your future is to live in this state, that you perceive the supreme principle and it infuses your every gesture, that your words contain the light of consciousness, shine with the profound depth of your understanding, that your words don't weave delusion and doubt in your mind or anybody else's, but clear that. That your mind is so clear you can understand even the most difficult subject. Only such a superior being, I'm paraphrasing Muktananda, only such a superior being has fully utilized the gift of Shaktipat and grown into the knowledge of the truth. Although your eyes appear to look outside, your gaze is constantly fixed on the inner self. You live in the wisdom of consciousness. You are serene. And you live in a state of compassion and share that with all others. You move through the world with your senses under control. You have conquered the six inner enemies. Desire, greed, anger, lust, envy, and infatuation. You are proficient in all actions. You have attained the fearlessness of the self. You regard all deities and religions as equal. You are free of attachments, always happy and independent. You are brave and compassionate, always smiling. And your speech brings joy. Only one who possesses these qualities can be said to be a knower of the truth. You must not pursue the qualities. You pursue the self. You cultivate and you support your inner state, and then it shines through you, and you're adorned with these qualities because you are the self. This is your task. This is your dharma. This is why you were born and what you're working on. This is why you do the practices you do. This is what it means to be a shisha. Om sahana bhavatu, sahana bhunatu, sahaviryam karavavahai. Tejasvinavadhitamastu ma vidvishabhai. Om shanti shanti shantihi. Om svarupa svasvabhava namo namaha. Again and again I bow.